he want me to be refined, hence the new nightwear? Well, that's not what he's going to get. This is me, practical, methodical, efficient, as I work my way through the contents on the plate. The chicken isn't half bad, nor the potatoes, or what turns out to be green beans. Not that I'm seeking flavor. I chew for sustenance, because now I'm not hungry. And after several cautious sips of the water, nor am I thirsty. I am fine. I'm okay. I am alone in the dark, and I'm perfectly all right. Later, my back to the watcher's window, squatted down to shield my body from view, I fold the styrofoam plate around my fists and use it as a makeshift shield as I hammer my hands against the shattered side of the coffin. My efforts are rewarded as I break off 2, 3, 4 shards of pine. Now I just need a place to hide them. In the dark, dark room where I can see nothing but he can see all, I cup the thin splinters in my palms, then wrap my hands around the 2/3 full water bottle. Let him think I'm trying to hide that as I shuffle back to my mattress, plastic bottle clutched to my chest. I lie down with my back to the one-way mirror, then, moving slowly, I use the longer, sharper wooden shard to work the welted edge of the mattress. I only need a small slit, 1 inch across, does it? Then I can slide in the first wooden splinter, the second, the third. Pine is a soft wood. I doubt the fragments will be terribly effective as weapons, but then again, jab a sliver in the eye. Resources. What I have that he doesn't even know he should take away. I curl my knees up and around the water bottle. I think, as I start to drift off again, that I'm not hungry. I'm not thirsty. I'm not cold. I'm not hot. I'm not in pain, nor exhausted, nor terrified. I am a girl ready to fight. Chapter 22. In a detective's world, there was one true blight on society, and it wasn't the master criminal. After all, super predators were few and far between. It was the media. Sunday afternoon, Dee Dee definitely needed to question Colin Summers. In the comfort of his own home would be ideal, as the less he felt threatened, the more likely he would be to talk. However, given the various media-fueled rumors that Devin Goulding was the same man who'd kidnapped Stacy Summers, Dee Dee didn't have to drive out to the Summers residence to know it would be a war zone of illegally parked news vans, feisty photographers, and rabid reporters. The arrival of a Boston sergeant detective known for her past work on several major cases would only fan the flames. Even sending out Pam Mason, the family's victim specialist, would stir the pot. So, Sunday afternoon, Dee Dee, Keynes, and Pam Mason sat in Keynes's office and, instead of actively searching for Florence Dane, brainstormed ways of outsmarting the media in order to get Colin Summers alone for questioning. It took another round of coffee to get the job done, with Keynes sticking to water. Dee Dee didn't trust him. Anyone who could appear that alert and engaged without at least one cup of Joe? Pam came up with the winning plan. She would call Colin, request that he come to his office for a meeting with her. He would understand immediately she had something to say outside the prying eyes of media, and while the news vans could follow him to his downtown office building, they were shut out of the high-rise itself, given it was private property. Colin could ride the elevator up to his 11th-floor suite, which should be relatively quiet on a Sunday afternoon. Dee Dee and Pam would meet him there. Keynes would remain behind, as 3 against 1 would appear too threatening for the kinds of questions they needed to ask. Keynes didn't argue, merely nodded. Dee Dee wondered what it would take to ruffle the senior victim specialist. Or maybe that was the point. In his line of work, at this stage of his career, he really had seen it all. Pam made the call. Dee Dee could only hear her side of it, but it was clear Colin was already champing at the bit, demanding to know who, what, why, when, and how. But Pam, an experienced handler, kept her voice calm and her request simple. Meet me at your office. Meet me at your office. Meet me at your office. Eventually, Colin must have given up on beating his head against the iron wall of her answers and agreed to meet her at his office. 3 o'clock. The hour wait gave Dee Dee time to check in with her team. Keynes showed her an unoccupied office she could use, and she quickly dialed Phil, filling him in on the game plan.
"So you want me to meet with Colin Summers at 3? He asked.
"No." She frowned over the phone.
"I got it."
Pause.
"Can I ask a question?"
"Maybe."
"What part of duty are you restricting? I mean, given that you are on restricted duty."
"I'm not carrying my sidearm," she informed him curtly.
"Why? Think I need one to interview an investment banker?"
"No. I think you need to trust your squad. Let us work while you boss us around. Come on, what's not to love?"
"I don't have time for this conversation," she informed him.
"You mean the one where I'm right and you know it?"
She growled. Her former squad mate didn't laugh.
"Dee Dee, we care about you. You're just coming back from a major injury suffered on the job when you went off all alone without notifying Neil or me to review a crime scene. Can you not see the pattern? And do you not understand how much that hurts us?"
No, I'm wrong. How much that pisses us off. We were your partners, and you didn't even give us a chance to have your back."
That brought Dee Dee up short. One, because Phil, father of 4, never swore. And 2, because calm, good-natured, always understanding Phil definitely sounded angry.
"I didn't mean it that way."
"You never mean it that way. That's the point. You think of yourself.
I think of my case, which has a whole team working on it. Exactly my point."
Dee Dee didn't know what to say. Phil was chastising her. Phil never chastised her. That was her job.
"So, you want to question Colin Summers?" she asked quietly.
Though she didn't want Phil to interview Stacy Summers' father, she wanted to do it. Meet the man, pass judgment on how he responded to each line of inquiry. It was her nature to want to do and see for herself, not because she didn't trust her squad, but simply because she was who she was. Just ask Alex.
"I can't," Phil said.
"You can't?"
"I got a bead on Christy Kilka, whose driver's license we found in Devin Goulding's bedroom."
"The one who's supposedly studying abroad in Italy?"
"Yeah. Did some digging. According to her university, Christy never signed up for a study abroad program. So either she lied to her mother, or her mother's lying to us. I got uniformed patrol officers picking up the mom now and bringing her down for questioning."
"Keep me posted. Any word on Natalie Draga?"
"Yeah. Heard back from her grandmother in Mobile. Natalie headed to Boston last year, called home a few times, but Grandma Draga hasn't heard from her in a bit. Best she recalls, Natalie had gotten a job as a waitress in a bar. But it doesn't sound like she and her granddaughter are exactly close, so as for such details as where Natalie lived, possible roommates, friends, Grandma Draga doesn't know, doesn't care."
"Which bar?"
"Grandma didn't know. But per your savvy, restricted duty sergeant commands," Phil uttered the words dryly, "couple of district detectives paid a visit to Devin Goulding's employer yesterday afternoon.
Tonic."
"Yep. They flashed photos of Natalie Draga and Christy Kilka. Bar manager ID'd Natalie Draga as a former employee, but claims she hasn't seen her in months. Draga walked out one day, never came back."
"Christy Kilker?" Dee Dee asked, wondering if they could be so lucky as to have both women connected so quickly to Devin Goulding.
"No such luck, but Carol is headed over to Tonic now to copy Natalie's pay stubs," Phil said.
"More and more. Looks like Devin Goulding has direct ties to at least Natalie Draga, working at the same bar and all."
"Carol will figure out the details," Phil assured her.
Dee Dee tried to stop her automatic snort. She was only half successful.
"Come on now," Phil said immediately. "Why are you so hard on her? Carol Manley is a perfectly good detective with an excellent track record. Not to mention she has a golden retriever named Harley. How can you not like a woman with a dog named Harley?"
Dee Dee didn't answer. Her feelings regarding the new detective were irrational, and she knew it.
"I thought Carol was reviewing video feeds from all the cameras surrounding Florence Dane's apartment," she asked.
"Officers are executing those warrants now. When they have the videos, she'll start reviewing. But in the meantime..."
Dee Dee couldn't argue with that. It did take longer to amass security footage than one might think. We need to find Flora, she muttered. Then, given that you're the boss, how about requesting more manpower? Because between working Devin Goulding from yesterday and now this from this morning, we're stretched thin. You know, so thin, even the restricted duty boss lady feels a need to work in the field. Touché. Not that it's my place to tell you what to do. Phil sounded cranky again. Dee Dee hesitated, wondered if there were things here she was still missing. God knows she'd never considered that Phil and Neil might be taking her injury so personally. Left alone, she had a natural bossy streak, even before she, the younger detective, was appointed a supervisor over Phil, who had more years on the job, though she'd always been the lead detective on their three-man squad. Phil, she started.
Hold on.
Okay, Mrs. Kilka has just arrived. Time for me to earn my paycheck. Good luck with Colin Summers. Same. Then come home?
Cop speak for returning to HQ.
Sure, then I'll be home. See you here.
Phil hung up. Dee Dee stood there a while longer, wondering again what she was missing and, if she was such an excellent detective, why the men in her life remained such mysteries to her. Colin Summers worked for a major investment bank in the financial sector of Boston, adjacent to Faneuil Hall. From the FBI's downtown office, it was easier for Pam and Dee Dee to walk to the stately pink granite building than battle out-of-state tourists driving hopelessly lost on increasingly narrow side streets. Dee Dee's favorite leather coat wasn't completely up to the job of battling the late fall chill, but she hunched her shoulders and soldiered through. Pam, she noticed, had exchanged her suit jacket and silk blouse for a cable-knit sweater and gold-toned scarf. Still dressy, but more approachable than the earlier buttoned-up affair. Not a bad strategy, in other words, when about to ambush an angry father about just how far he might have gone to get his missing daughter back. Like many corporate offices in Boston, the banking building had a manned lobby, even on Sundays. Pam did the honors for both of them, flashing her ID and stating they had a 3 o'clock meeting with Colin Summers. The young rent-a-cop stifled a yawn. No doubt they'd interrupted quality time watching YouTube videos on his cell phone, then dialed up. Colin must have already been there to vouch for them as they were immediately waved through.
I'll take the lead, Pam said briskly as they rode the elevator up.
Dee Dee didn't argue. Pam had an established relationship with the subject, and despite what Phil might think, Dee Dee wasn't that big a control freak.
Maybe.
They arrived on the 11th floor lobby, one set of glass doors to the left, a second set to the right. Both appeared dark and secured. Pam turned to the left, and sure enough, a man appeared on the other side of the door, gaunt face already set in a grim mask as he buzzed them through. Dee Dee had never met Colin Summers before, just spoken to him by phone, plus seen him on TV, pleading for his daughter's safe return. He must have recognized her from various press conferences as well, because immediately...
I knew it! I knew it! If she's here!
He stuck a finger out at Dee Dee.
Then that Goulding bastard's death did have something to do with my daughter. Did you find her? Do you have any news? Where is she? Where's Stacy?
Colin, Pam said. Not soothing, which surprised Dee Dee, but firm.
We haven't found Stacy. Trust me, I'd be sitting with both you and your wife right now if we had.
Colin scowled but nodded. Apparently that made sense to him.
We do, however, have a new line of inquiry that might help us find her. So please, may we?
Pam gestured to the glass doors, which Colin had buzzed open but was still blocking with his body. Grudgingly, the man fell back. Pam shot Dee Dee a look, then both of them entered. They walked into a tight receptionist area, punctuated by a striking wall of gray slate, modern and sophisticated, as befitting a major I-bank. Colin headed to the right, swiping his employee ID as they passed through another set of secured doors. Then they entered the heart of the matter, a vast open space dotted with cubicles in the middle and a row of rooms with a view to the right. Most of the cubicles were empty, as they'd hoped, the space only half-lit.
but Dee Dee could hear the clickety-clack sound of typing in the distance, as well as the low murmur of a voice on the phone. Young up-and-comers, she figured, still fighting to get ahead by logging Sunday hours. A vice president with the firm, Colin, had already paid his dues. He led them to the proverbial corner office, and Dee Dee couldn't help but be impressed. A massive cherry desk, mammoth black leather executive chair, even more startling, a city view. Sure, he was peering down a narrow street running between two other high-rise buildings, but still, the cobblestones of Faneuil Hall beckoned in the distance, bustling with tiny, wide-eyed tourists and hungry locals enjoying the weekend. Dee Dee tore her gaze from the windows and took in the gold-framed diplomas punctuating the adjacent wall. Pam Mason hadn't been lying. There appeared to be no problem Colin's advanced intellect and financial success couldn't solve. Except, of course, for the matter of his missing daughter. Colin had already taken a seat behind his mammoth desk. Under normal circumstances, Dee Dee thought, he would have been considered good-looking. Close-cropped, sandy blonde hair, intense blue eyes, trim, athletic figure, work-hard, play-hard kind of guy. His mouth, however, was set too hard and thin. Not cruel, but grim. And his face, upon closer inspection, was hollowed out, a workaholic under more than his usual load of stress, a man watching helplessly as his family fell apart. He didn't offer water or coffee, he just sat, the desk an obvious shield before him, as he stared at Dee Dee and waited for her to speak. Pam took one of the wingback chairs from the seating area and dragged it over. Perfectly calm and unruffled, she gestured for Dee Dee to take a seat. Then she dragged over a second chair for herself. True to her word, Dee Dee waited for Pam to take the lead, which, given how hard Colin was staring at her, as if already he considered Dee Dee the enemy, was definitely the right approach. "How is Pauline?" Pam asked after a moment. She took her time getting settled into her seat, making herself comfortable. In contrast to Colin's grim features, she appeared relaxed, engaged. She could have been meeting old friends for brunch. "How do you think?" Colin bit out, eyes blazing, "especially given yesterday." "Did you know Devin Goulding, Colin? Ever frequent Tonic Bar? Recognize his picture on the news?" "You mean other than he's a perfect match for the guy who abducted my daughter?" "Sergeant Detective Dee Dee Warren." Pam turned abruptly. "Can you please tell Mr. Summers what you found in Devin Goulding's house?" Dee Dee startled. She had no intention of giving up any such information. But Colin was already leaning forward, face nearly feverish. He wasn't going to back off, she realized. He believed they knew something and were intentionally keeping him in the dark. As long as that was the case, they would get nothing from him and go nowhere in this interview. She'd agreed to let the victim advocate take the lead, so Pam Mason had made the executive decision. Sometimes you gotta pay to play. They would pay Colin Summers with this information and hope he returned the favor. "We found photos," Dee Dee offered, "belonging to a young woman he was clearly stalking. We also found driver's licenses hidden away in his bedroom. We have yet to locate either woman from the licenses." Colin hissed in a breath. As much as he'd clearly been anticipating such news, it had still caught him off guard. "We believe Devin Goulding was a predator. We believe it's possible that both of those young women fell victim to him, that their licenses are trophies of a sort." "He killed them," Colin said. "We don't know. We have detectives working on locating each woman, but as of now, you can't find them." "We haven't found them." "He killed them," Colin repeated. "Give us another 48 hours, Dee Dee said, thinking of the progress being made by her very excellent team, "and we can probably answer that." "Now, tell him what you didn't find," Pam interjected firmly. Dee Dee kept her gaze on Colin Summers, who was still leaning forward, shoulders rigid. "We didn't find any sign of Stacy. No photos, no driver's license, not a strand of hair, nor trace of fiber." Colin didn't sit back. He didn't relax. He just continued to stare at her as if he couldn't absorb such news. "Mr. Summers, I told you the truth this morning. We believe Devin Goulding was a rapist, maybe even a murderer, but we don't, as of this time, have any reason to believe he was the man who took your daughter. In fact, given his custom of keeping trophies, the driver's licenses, photos, chances are he's not. But you're here." "Colin?" Pam interjected. "It's time for you to tell us what you know about Goulding, why you suspect him for your daughter's case." "What? How would I know him? I just heard about him on the news like everyone else." He shot Dee Dee another angry glance. "Really? And what did Flora have to say about him?" Colin flinched. His gaze dropped. Abruptly, he sat back. All the better to put distance between him and them, Dee Dee thought. "Colin, I know you want answers. Pam again. I know you love your daughter. I know you would do anything to get her back. Did you hire a private investigator?" Dee Dee spoke up. "To help find Stacy?" Colin didn't speak. He no longer appeared angry to Dee Dee, but stark, a father who was trying to keep his heart from breaking. "Mr. Summers, I can get a warrant for your phone records," Dee Dee continued, "as well as the security cameras in this building. Such actions will take away resources the Boston police could otherwise spend continuing the search for your daughter. But if I have to..." "I know Rosa Dane," he conceded abruptly. "She's our mentor. I told you that." "She shared her story with you, correct? That's part of her role, letting you know what she went through and, even more importantly, that even after being kidnapped for over a year, a daughter can come home again." Colin nodded. "Rosa's honest. She told you about Flora's struggles, didn't she? About how you can get a happy ending but still not live happily ever after? How her own daughter has spent the past 5 years obsessed with criminal behavior and self-defense in order to try to feel safe again?" Colin didn't say anything. "And that got you thinking. The police haven't been able to help you. Apparently you weren't satisfied with any of the private investigators you interviewed." He scowled at Pam, clearly irritated that the victim specialist had revealed so much. "So, what about Flora Dane? What about a girl who's truly been there and done that, who's become something of an expert on kidnapping and abduction? Why not talk to her?" He chewed his lower lip. "You met her here," Pam spoke up, "in this office. It's the only place you have any privacy, and you wouldn't want Pauline to know. It would upset her. And you wouldn't want me to know because I wouldn't approve. So you contacted Flora and arranged to meet her here. Remember, Colin, we can pull security footage." "Fine. I met with Flora. In this office. We just talked, though. After everything Rosa had said, I was curious to meet Flora in person. A survivor, you know? Someone who did make it. As for Flora, she'd clearly been following Stacy's case. She had questions of her own." "When did you meet with her?" Dee Dee asked. "I don't know, 3 weeks ago? I want the day, Monday, Tuesday, third Saturday of October, be specific." Colin scowled, but after a moment he pulled out his cell phone, consulted his calendar. "Tuesday, second week of October, 3 p.m. Better?" "How long did you talk?" "Hour, maybe 90 minutes. "Did she have theories on Stacy's abduction?" Pam interjected. Colin shrugged. "Nothing new, just the usual. What did we know of her online activities? Who were her friends she went out with that night? How big a drinker? Could she handle herself? She wanted to know about Stacy's resources. I mean, my daughter's athletic. People don't always take it seriously, but cheerleading is an intense sport. Flora said that would be a mark in my daughter's favor. Then she wanted to know if Stacy had taken any self-defense, karate, carried mace, anything like that. She hadn't. What about mental resilience, how my daughter functioned under pressure? I couldn't really answer. Maybe Pauline could. But my job, my whole life, has been to keep my daughter from being under that kind of stress, to take care of her, to keep her safe. Colin Summers' voice broke. He looked away. Neither Pam nor Dee Dee spoke. After another moment, he composed himself. "I said Stacy's smart. If she could figure a way out, she would, but also Stacy's sweet. And I don't just mean that as her father. From a very early age, she has always been so likable. Total strangers gravitate to her, and she gravitates to them. She's one of those people. She sees the best in everyone. Flora said that might help her. She said the guy who kidnapped her used to talk about killing her all the time. She listened, agreed with everything he said, did whatever he wanted. And eventually the guy didn't talk about killing her anymore. Eventually he decided to keep her instead. Did Flora think Stacy was still alive? Dee Dee asked curiously. Too late, she caught Pam's warning glance. Of course my daughter is still alive. And Flora agreed with this assessment. She thought it was highly possible. Colin? Pam interjected quietly. Did you hire Flora to find your daughter? No, of course not. I mean, she's just a kid herself, a past victim. I'd never do such a thing. Remember, we can subpoena your financials. Colin glared at the victim specialist. At what point are you on my side on any of this? Why don't you consider me on Pauline's side? Pam Mason smiled sweetly. Colin blanched. I didn't hire Flora, not exactly. She offered to help. Dee Dee filled in. She was already well-versed on the case, had been following it on her own, and her mother hadn't exaggerated. The things she knew, talked about? Flora Dane was more impressive than any of the private investigators I interviewed, and definitely more vested in finding my daughter than any of you detectives have been. Dee Dee's turned to arch a brow, but never argue with a grieving father. How much did you pay her? She asked in clipped tones. Nothing. But Dee Dee caught the edge. Nothing yet? She sat back. Reward. You offered her a reward if she helped find your daughter. We're already offering a public reward. Nothing wrong with that. I disagree. Flora Dane may talk the talk, but at the end of the day, she is just a young woman, a past victim. You took advantage of her obsessions. She offered. Given how little progress the professionals have made, I didn't feel inclined to argue. But no money has changed hands, and you can't prove a thing. Did she bring you word of your daughter? No. Actually, I hadn't heard anything more from her, but I figured it would take time for her to work her channels, as she called it. Then, Saturday, when I turned on the news and heard about that bartender, I knew. I knew it had to be Flora, searching for my daughter. Except Devin Goulding didn't kidnap your daughter. Shouldn't you be asking Flora about that? We can't. Flora's gone missing. In fact, we have reason to believe she was abducted from her apartment sometime late yesterday, perhaps by the same man who took Stacy. I guess you can say we do have a new lead in your daughter's case, Mr. Summers. We're no longer looking for one missing girl. We're now looking for at least two. Chapter 23. No one wants to be a monster. Fake Everett told me this time and time again. It wasn't his fault he was the way he was. He didn't ask to have sex fantasies every minute of every waking hour, to be turned on by pictures of big-boobed girls bound and gagged, to be aroused by the sound of metal chains snaking across the floor. He once read a news story about a peeping Tom discovered in the honey bucket of some state park's composting toilet. The peeping Tom made up some tale of having lost his wedding ring, had to go in after it, but the police discovered the guy had a whole history of being caught in porta-johns, outhouses, all that crap. Fake Everett would laugh as he said the word crap, pleased with himself. Anyway, some expert claimed the guy had a potty fetish. He was aroused by standing in poo, spying on strange women doing duty. Not making this up, Fake Everett would say, taking his hands off the steering wheel of his big rig as if to prove his point. Now, who in his right mind would choose to be turned on by crap? Everett would continue. It was a sickness, clearly, an obsession he probably wished he didn't have. Imagine a life sneaking around looking for public potties, covered in stench. Well, kidnapping me, raping me, assaulting me, that wasn't his fault either. Fake Everett was very earnest on this subject. For as long as he'd had memory, he'd been filled with thoughts of sex. Even as a little boy, before he knew what sex was, he'd stare at boobs and wish he could touch them. His mom's, his grandma's, total strangers, it didn't matter. He knew there was something out there he wanted, had to have. Just took him a bit to understand what it all meant. And then... he'd tried to be normal. He'd whine, have a girlfriend, stick to missionary, tell himself he could be satisfied with 3 times a night. He'd even gotten himself a wife. Surely that would work. Except he didn't want plain Jane sex. He didn't want some dutiful wife lying like a cold fish beneath him. He was a man. He had needs and obsessions. Deep, hardwired fantasies and thoughts he couldn't let go, even if no one understood but him. He'd beat up his first wife, pounded her to a bloody pulp so bad he'd had to call an ambulance. The docs in the ER had ratted him out, and the police had arrested him while his wife was still unconscious and couldn't explain it was all her fault. A good wife should never say no. He'd had to serve time, which had been a lesson in and of itself. Plenty of sex behind bars, don't get him started, but none of it was his kind of deal. Definitely no place for a man with his needs. In prison, he'd had to attend group sessions for rage management, impulse control, even learned about sex addiction. First time he'd ever heard there was something abnormal about wanting so much sex all the time, something unhealthy. He decided when he got out he'd try to quit. Like an alcoholic, he'd go cold turkey. No sex, no terrible hungers, no fits of rage, no more time in jail. Good deal. Except people can live without alcohol. But no man can live without sex. Which is how he ended up attacking a 14-year-old girl. Not his fault. He didn't ask to be born this way. No one wants to be a monster. His mama wasn't bad. His father, well, yeah, he was a real asshole. But he was never around. Nah, fake Everett was raised by his mama, who worked 2 jobs, chain-smoking in between. When he was real little, he'd shuttled between her and his grandma's house. When he was older, 6 or 7, he'd stayed home alone. He'd watch TV shows where the women were super skinny with massive chests and clingy tops. Then he found his father's stash of skin mags. After that, he couldn't wait for his mother's work shifts. He spent hour after hour flipping through pages, staring at all the pictures. When he was 13, he explained, as we drove across the state of Alabama, he wanted to be a porn star, thought it would be the best job in the whole world. Of course, when he turned 16 and his chest was still a scrawny, hairless wasteland, and his face was covered in acne and his hair was an oil slick, even a total fuck-up like him could realize porn stars looked one way, and he didn't. He still loved porn. And now, thanks to the wonders of the Internet, he could take it with him everywhere. None of this surprised me. I already knew the second fake Everett was done driving for the day, he'd load up his favorite sex videos into the DVD player, pop open my prison, and we'd be off and running. It didn't matter if I was tired or hungry or sore. It didn't even matter if he was tired or hungry or sore. A man had needs. This was his biggest need. No one wants to be a monster. You can teach yourself not to feel anything, to fly away. Sometimes I pictured myself in the meadow, playing with the foxes, but I didn't like that. It felt too tainted. So I pictured bright blue sky, a bluebird sky, we called it in New England, when the winter sky turned a rich, true blue versus the overbright, summer-bleached alternative. During the day, I was the perfect listener. An audience of one for a man who could really talk and talk and talk. Then by night I became an inanimate object, to be moved and positioned and posed this way and that by the same narcissistic asshole. What did it matter to me? Eventually, when he was done, he'd offer me food, or a drag of his cigarette, or a swig from his beer. We would sit in silence, the big rig filled with the scents of sweat and sex, and for a minute... or 2 or 3, he'd almost seem happy. "You're pretty," he told me once. "That's why I had to take you. I saw you, dancing. All that hair jiggling right above your ass made a man look all right. Except, of course, a girl like you. You'd never even give someone like me the time of day." He stated it matter-of-factly. I didn't argue. So I did it my way, and here we are. to run the country like two crazy fools. Now what do you think, burgers or pizza for dinner tonight?
He fed me. Then there would be more sex. Then back to the box for me. Except as days became weeks, sometimes he fell asleep. Sometimes I got to stay there, lying on the softness of the sleeping bag, my wrists still bound, one ankle shackled to a large metal ring on the floor, but still. I didn't sleep those nights. I forced my eyes to stay open. I drank in the slippery feel of the nylon sleeping bag versus my usual bed of hard pine. I took in the softness of night, just beyond the sleeper cab's narrow windows. I listened to him snore, and I thought, if I could just get my bound wrists around his neck, or find the strength to press a pillow against his face or shove a pencil into his eye. But I never made any such moves, never acted on my own fantasies. Sometimes when he was sleeping, he almost looked human. Just another guy, grateful to have survived another day. I wondered if his mother or grandmother were still alive. I wondered if they missed him, or if they knew by now who he truly was and regretted their mistakes. I didn't think of my mom anymore, or my brother, or the beauty of foxes. I lived flying against a bluebird sky. And there were good days, when I got to sit on the passenger seat of the cab, my bound hands out of sight, and watch the countryside rush by. Then there were bad days, where something pissed him off and he drank more and hit more and punished me more. But there were lots of days that were merely days. When fake Everett would talk, I would listen. The road would roll by, and maybe a song would come on the radio, and I would surprise myself by humming along, and he would surprise me by joining in, and we'd sing along to Taylor Swift. I learned he liked the Carol Burnett Show and I Love Lucy episodes, and Bonanza, which he used to watch with his grandma, while I talked about SNL and my addiction to Grey's Anatomy. "McDreamy," he said, surprising me. Later he showed up with a box set of Grey's Anatomy's first few seasons and loaded a disc into the DVD player for me. That night, as he pounded away like a jackhammer, I thought of Seattle hospitals and ridiculously good-looking doctors. And maybe one day, someday, a hunky intern holding my hand as they rushed in my bruised and battered form. I'd been rescued. I'd escaped. I'd finally killed fake Everett, and now for my reward. A McDreamy of my own to heal my wounds and keep me safe forever. But I didn't dream that much. I didn't think ahead or wonder about that future or what would one day become of me. Mostly I flew against a bluebird sky, my body bound, but my mind long gone.
"Lindy."
He woke me up, crying out in his sleep one night.
"Lindy, Lindy, Lindy."
He sounded like he was sobbing piteously, fingers scrabbling against the sleeping bag beside me.
"No, no, no," he cried. "Oh, Lindy."
Do monsters have nightmares? Do they even dream? He sounded like he was dying, as if his world had ended, as if fake Everett must have once had a heart, because now it was being ripped out of his chest. I found myself running fingers down his back. I could feel the tension in his muscles, the raggedness of his breath. A man in pain. I stroked his back again, gently, until eventually he sighed heavily. His shoulders came down. He slept. Later, when he woke up and declared once again that a man had needs, I didn't shy away. I kept my eyes open, staring at him, wondering who Lindy was and what she'd done that gave her such power over him. And what I could learn from her. More days, more nights, till one afternoon he pulled into a truck stop, went inside to grab coffee, and without thinking about it, left me sitting there, hands bound, left ankle shackled to yet another metal ring on the floor, but still, sitting in plain sight. A state police cruiser pulled in, parked beside me, door swung open. A tall man in uniform stepped out. He spotted me, nodded once, fingers on the brim of his cap, and I sat with my hands fisted on my lap. I said nothing. I did nothing. While my heart accelerated madly in my chest, and for a moment, I had a memory. like a tickle in the back of my throat. My mom. I could picture her perfectly, her arms outstretched, waiting for me. She was saying a name. Molly. Except that wasn't quite right, was it? I wanted to raise my bound hands. I wanted to bang on the window, show my tied wrists. I wanted to yell, "My name is... my name is..." I wanted to beg, "Please just take me home." The state trooper staring right at me, myself, hands on my lap, staring right back. And then, in the next instant, I could see what he saw. A skinny white trash girl with cheap clothes, lifeless eyes, and hacked-off blonde hair. I saw Molly, sitting in a big rig, waiting for her wife-beating man to return to her. And I didn't feel like a bird about to burst out of its cage. I didn't feel like a girl about to go home. I felt ashamed. Like the shit-brown carpet, so many shades of nasty. I wiped my mother's image from my mind. I replaced her face with a bluebird sky, and I focused my gaze dead ahead. The state trooper walked away. Fake Everett returned. He spotted the cruiser, jerked open the cab door, already appearing panicked. Then he saw me, just sitting there, eyes locked forward. He got in, buckled up, drove away. Neither of us said a word. That night when he was done, he didn't put me back in the box. He let me stay out, night after night, day after day. No more coffin-sized box. Because Flora didn't exist anymore, and we both knew it. I wrote another postcard to my mom. "Dear Mom," I wrote, "having the best time touring the country with the man of my dreams." Chapter 24. Upon waking, I reach immediately for the water bottle, discovering it still tucked in the curve of my body. Good. Lights remain out, the room its usual soul-sucking black. It doesn't frighten me as much as it makes me impatient. Sooner or later, he's going to flash on the lights. Not even monsters want to spend all their time in the dark. For now, I orient myself, concentrating on the thin plastic of the water bottle, the lacy edge of my ridiculous nightie, and the welted edge of my mattress. And moisture, I realize belatedly, on my cheeks, along with the taste of salt. I've been crying in my sleep. I dreamed of Jacob. I lift my bound hands and quickly wipe the tears from my face. I don't think about it. I don't dwell on it. Survivors should never second-guess. If I hadn't done what I did, I'd never be here today. Once again kidnapped, dealing with cheap pine coffins. I make a barking noise that might be laughter, hard to tell. My throat's dry. I decide to risk a small sip of water. It's an important resource. A person can survive weeks without food, but only days without water. I know these things now. I deliberately researched them. Which makes me angry at the impenetrable dark again. I didn't study and train all these years just to be locked away like a pair of old shoes. Where the hell is my captor anyway? Doesn't he want to gloat? Punish me? Assert his sexual superiority? What kind of freak goes to all this trouble, then never shows his face? I sit up, swing my legs over the edge of the thin mattress. An old pro by now, I sniff the air first, trying to detect any new scents that might indicate another meal delivery, even the smell of soap, shampoo, body odor, to signal someone else's presence in the room. I get nothing. Next up, as long as I'm playing blind man's bluff, sound. More carefully modulated breathing? Or the distant hum of traffic beyond the blacked-out windows, muffled thumps or thuds from other rooms in the house? Once again, nothing. I start crawling, bump against the plastic bucket, veer right. I continue through the room to where there should be the remnants of the pine coffin, except this time when I find nothing, it actually means something. He's removed the shards, realized they could be utilized as weapons, and quickly carted them away, which, of course, makes me immediately wonder about the ones I stashed inside the seam of my mattress. But I don't dare double back to check, not when he could be watching. Instead, I sit back on my heels, considering, how is he doing this?
entering and exiting the room so quietly. It's one thing for him to observe through the viewing window, then make his move once he thinks I'm asleep, except I'm an extremely light sleeper. The odds of him dragging entire coffin-shaped boxes in and out without me ever stirring... He must be drugging me. Sneaking in and placing more chloroform over my mouth? Except contrary to popular belief, it's not that easy to instantly knock someone out with a chloroform-soaked rag, meaning I should have woken up fighting or even now detected remnants of the odor in the air. On the other hand, addicts, sniffers, and the like have perfected mixing chloroform with other drugs to produce a much more powerful cocktail. If my abductor has access to the internet or spends any amount of time in a nightclub, God only knows what he could have learned. Which leads me to an even more basic question. How is he getting in? So far, I've found evidence of two single windows on what I believe is the exterior wall, plus the larger pane of glass, the one-way mirror, on the opposite wall. But there has to be a door, of course. Every room has a door. I focus my eyes in the gloom, trying to identify a thin seam of lighter dark framing a doorway. But no matter how much I squint and strain, I see nothing. Evil kidnappers' blackout capabilities are very good. Fine. The Helen Keller method it is. I crawl toward the wall with the viewing window first. If the two single windows are on an exterior wall, then basic architecture makes this the longest interior wall, which, in my mind, makes it the most likely to have a door. In fact, the more I think about it, the more I'm convinced this wall must abut a hallway, hence the viewing window. He stands in the hall, staring in. I stand up gingerly once I hit drywall. It feels strange to stand, and it occurs to me I've spent most of my time on my hands and knees, crawling around in the dark. Falling back into bad behaviors, I realize, making myself small. But there's no reason in this space I can't stand and walk. For that matter, some yoga and light calisthenics would be a good idea. I'm fed, I'm hydrated, I should also work on remaining strong. I find the black painted trim of the viewing window easily enough. It's nearly as long as the full stretch of my open arms. But, upon further inspection, it's not mounted in the middle of the wall, as you might expect. No, it's off to one side, leaving plenty of wall space to the left for a door. I shuffle sideways, fingers skimming over the drywall. I wonder if he's standing on the other side of the viewing window right now. Intrigued by my efforts? Nervous? There are so many kinds of predators in the world. Those who require submissive victims, and those who like it when you fight back. The obvious sign of a door would be a doorknob. Definitely no such luck. So I sway side to side, slipping my fingers across the wall in broad horizontal strokes, determined to feel the slight hiccup that would indicate the edge of a door. But nothing, nothing, nothing. I pause, consider the room design again. I'd pictured the two single windows as being part of an external wall, say the front of a house, which would mean this room is positioned as a long rectangle in the home. But what if the two single windows are actually on the side of the house, meaning the room isn't a horizontal dash, but a tall eye? That would put the viewing window on a wall most likely adjacent to another room, a viewing room to go with the viewing window, while one of the narrower walls would be most likely to open to a corridor. I shift counterclockwise, moving from the long wall to the skinnier one. Again, my fingers span from side to side, looking for a protruding doorknob, a narrow ridge, and then I find it. No doorknob, but definitely a seam in the wall, which I can trace up to the top of my fingertips, then down to the floor and across. Yes, a door. Fit flush into the black-painted walls with no protruding knob or metal locking mechanism to make it stand out. How does he open it, then? A knob on his side? But surely he'd want it secured as well. Maybe he has bolts mounted on the outside of the door that he can manually work, then pull the door open and walk through. I know in the next moment what I'm going to do. I return to my mattress, turn it so it faces not the viewing room, but the door. I take a seat, and with my body as a shield to block my motions, I feel gingerly for the ripped edge of the mattress, my stash of wooden shards. I pull out two, feeling instant relief, which I refuse to show on my face. He's not the only one who can keep someone in the dark. I position my makeshift weapons along the length of my thigh. Then I reach down for the hem of my ridiculously stupid satin nightie and begin to tear. One long strip. Not easy to do, as the satin is happy to rip up, but not across. Through sheer stubbornness, I eventually win. Then I have it. Two soft pine wooden stakes as weapons. A strip of cloth tied around my mouth and nose to block, maybe, doubtfully, any kind of nefarious sleeping gas, and a plan. I take a seat, butt on mattress, shards tucked beneath my leg out of sight, and water bottle on my lap. I stare directly in the direction of where I know the door has to be, and, fingers wrapped around my weapon, I wait. I think I dozed off again. The effect of total darkness? Disorientation from the kidnapping? Drugs in my water? But this time, I catch the telltale rasp of a metal bolt sliding back. I told my subconscious what to listen for, setting it like an alarm, and it didn't let me down. I force myself to remain still, not lifting my head, not giving any sign of consciousness. It's possible there's more than one predator. I've read several cases of kidnappers who work in pairs. Now is not the time to be stupid. My bound hands press the two long, skinny pine shards into one larger, heavier unit, while my homemade satin mask wicks the moisture from my mouth and delivers the scent of musty cloth. Slowly the door eases open. Shades of black, I realize. No brightly lit corridor to suddenly flood my room with slashing rays of light and rouse me from slumber. No, this is a stealth job all the way. As the shadowy figure moves from the darkened hallway to the even more impenetrable gloom of my space, my fingers tighten on the pieces of wood. Not terribly tall. Or maybe he is hunched? Moving carefully, very carefully, as if not to wake me, I remind myself not to move. I remind myself to stay very still. Wait till the figure steps all the way into the room. Except halfway through the door, the figure stops. A hand comes up. To spray a drug? To render me unconscious? I can't take it anymore. I spring. With the sound of rattling chains, I leap to my feet and dart forward, pulling heavily on my tether. No thinking, just moving. Bound hands clasped tightly around the pine shards. The man realizes too late what's about to happen. He turns defensively, raises an arm to block. But I have trained harder. I have trained better. I drop beneath his forearm and drive my pine stakes into his ribs. He screams, high, shrill, distinctly feminine. He drops to the ground while behind him the door slams shut. Myself, standing wide-eyed in the dark, clutching my bloody weapon, wanting to wave it triumphantly over my fallen target. Except... something is not right here. The scream, distinctly feminine. The fallen figure whimpering and cowering at my feet. Slowly I sink to my knees. Slowly I set my wooden shards on the floor, and slowly, ever so slowly, I reach for the huddled form beside me. I encounter fistfuls of thick, shoulder-length hair. It tells me everything I don't want to know. "Stacy Summers?" I whisper. She cries harder, and I find myself nodding in the dark. I've finally found who I've spent weeks looking for. And I just stabbed her. Chapter 25. After the interview with Colin Summers, Dee Dee returned to HQ as promised. No doubt her inbox was already overflowing with reports to edit, warrants to review, and interrogations to read. She felt antsy, keyed up in a way she didn't like. Nervous about seeing Phil? Or simply over-adrenalized by a series of crimes that didn't make sense? First, the Devin Goulding scene, where the victim had turned out to be the perpetrator and his attacker also their prime suspect. Florence Dane had annoyed Dee Dee then, and not just with her unwillingness to answer routine questions, but because Flora didn't fit. Plain and simple, policing was about playing the odds. Find a wife murdered in her home, arrest the husband. Beaten child, handcuff the parents. Poisoned executive, haul in his hot business partner and former lover. Knowing who did it was rarely rocket science. Proving it was where Dee Dee and her squad mates earned their keep. Then you got cases such as Florence Dane, where you were looking at an animal with hooves and stripes, and yet it definitely wasn't a zebra. Dee Dee still didn't know what Flora was, who she was. Having finally made it safely home, why would the woman keep seeking out danger time and again? Because Dee Dee had no doubts. Flora had met with Colin Summers, and she'd made finding Stacy Summers her own personal mission. The question was, did Flora really want to save a young college student, or did she simply want a fresh target to kill? In Dee Dee's mind, that was a 50-50 proposition, which didn't make her less keen to locate Flora, but rather gave her a certain urgency on the subject. One way or another, whatever had happened to Flora and Stacy, whoever had happened, it was going to end badly. Because that's how Flora needed it to end, Dee Dee thought. Something had happened 5 years ago between her and her first kidnapper. After 472 days of captivity, something had gone down that left Jacob Ness dead and Flora very much alive. Except Flora had never gotten over it. And even now seemed to be seeking out the same sequence of events over and over again. Entering HQ, Dee Dee spotted Phil walking across the cavernous glass-and-chrome lobby with a steaming cup of coffee. Never one to shy away from conflict, Dee Dee headed straight to him. "Any chance that's for me?" Phil clutched his coffee close. "Back off. I've spent the past 2 hours with a crier. Trust me when I say I need this more than you." Dee Dee had to think about it. "Christy Kilker's mom?" she asked while sniffing at the wafting scent of dark roasted bliss. "Doesn't know a thing. Honestly thought her daughter was studying in Italy. Totally fell apart when I informed her Christy had never signed up for any such program." "Oh, hell, take it. I'll grab another." Phil thrust out his coffee. Dee Dee didn't argue. Peace offering, she decided, then gamely followed Phil into the lobby cafeteria where he could grab a second cup. "She hasn't had from a daughter in months. Was less than thrilled, but figured Christy was busy with her studies. Not to mention the two of them had a bit of a brouhaha right before Christy supposedly left town. So maybe Christy's nursing her wounds. Needless to say, to discover her daughter had been lying all along and was never in Italy..." "She close to her daughter?" Dee Dee asked, though the brouhaha, combined with the fact Christy had deceived her mother about her trip, seemed to say enough. "Used to be. According to the mom, Christy changed when she went off to college. Became less communicative, more secretive. Nancy, Christy's mom, worried her daughter had fallen in with the wrong crowd, that sort of thing. It was her idea for Christy to sign up for the international program. Figured it would be good for her to have a change of pace. She funded it, too, which wasn't easy on her secretary's salary. So to find out Christy lied about the program as well as pocketed the funds? Nancy's not having a good day." "She able to give you the names of some of Christy's college friends?" "Yeah, and I sent some uniforms over to start on-campus interviews with the dean of admissions, current professors, that sort of thing. But I don't think that's where the magic is." Phil paid for his second coffee. They walked together to the desk sergeant, flashing ID, getting waved through. Dee Dee headed for the stairwell, if only to torture her one-time squad mate further. "Okay, so where's the magic?" she prodded, as Phil began to climb the stairs wheezily beside her. "Christy had a job to help with her living expenses, part-time cocktail waitress." Dee Dee paused mid-step. "Someplace near Tonic?" "Devin Goulding's bar." "Yes, at Hashtag, just up the street. How much do you want to bet after hours Goulding was known to hang out there as well?" "Oh, you're not getting money out of me that easily. You got detectives visiting the place and flashing photos?" "As we speak." "Which would connect Devin Goulding with Christy Kilker, who hasn't been seen or heard from in... Mom hasn't gotten a call since June." Dee Dee resumed climbing. "That's like 5 months ago. She really thought her daughter was still hanging out in Italy?" Christy had planned to travel around on her own after the program ended in September, the whole me, my backpack, and various youth hostels experience, which by definition would mean she wouldn't have much money left for international calls, and apparently the mom herself doesn't care for email. So we have Natalie Draga, who left home a year ago, and Christy Kilker, who's been MIA for at least 5 months. Now, we know Natalie Draga actually worked at Tonic. Carol, have any luck talking to the manager?
Yeah,